Hey guys, James Cox, and I'm here today with Mitch Wagner. He is a professor at Western Connecticut State University, working in environmental sciences and the environment, helping educate the future about what we're going through. And he's been doing a lot of talks for a while. On the issue of the climate crisis. I refuse to call it climate change anymore because we've obviously entered a whole new phase with what's happened in the past couple of years. So, Mitch, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Happy to be here.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get involved in environmental science and especially kind of focusing on the climate crisis?
Well, I'm an ecology professor by training. I grew up in Missouri and went to undergrad at the University of Missouri, and then went to the University of Alaska for, of all places, for grad school, and did a couple of degrees up there in Fairbanks. And studied the taiga forest, the northern boreal forest, and permafrost, and all that jazz. And climate's a big deal up there. Even though climate change, anthropogenic climate changes had not really caught on in the public, mind so much yet, scientists were certainly aware of it, and they had started talking about doing research and stuff up there. I was part of an ecosystem level interdisciplinary study on the on that tiger forest, and so that just moves right on into climate change once the information was available and the urgency started to catch up, so that it was more than scientists who were talking about it. So, and then, in 1996, I've been in Connecticut for quite a while now. We moved to Fairbanks or to Danbury and got a, and I'm, when I've got a position at Western Connecticut State, I've been there ever since.
Nice. Nice. Now, one of the things that kind of brought us together for today is you have a talk that you're giving on how things are heating up and kind of want you just to kind of do your presentation and then we can kind of talk about things as you go because I'm sure you have a lot of information. But you mentioned working in the northern forest and when you first started, and my first thought is with all of the Canadian fires that we've had this year, I mean, that must be an immense loss of like a carbon sink.
Boy.
I mean, not only just the smoke that's generated, but just the loss of productive ability to absorb carbon that we need more than any other time.
Well, fires are a natural reset mechanism for forested ecosystems. Not only forests, but grasslands and even tundra burns sometimes. But what we're seeing now is something else again. It's a fire on the scale that is not previously seen. In fact, I'm getting ready to do slide talks on some local for a couple of local groups here in the Danbury area, and I looked up, statistics and stuff, and there has never been a. A there have not been fires like this in Canada in recorded history. Now, granted, that's not very long, but it's a natural thing to have fires. But what we have here is fires on the mega scale. So when you take a fire, when you take a forest and you burn it, you are taking away a large amount of the organism's ecosystem's ability to photosynthesize, and it has to start over, which is, like I say, it's that's not necessarily bad by itself. But you're also producing CO2 from all that burnt biomass, and you're releasing soot, that black stuff that comes out of fireplaces and wood stoves in the back of your car, maybe. And that stuff has the ability to get up in the environment, up in the atmosphere, and then settle out on top of ice. And when it does so, the ice becomes less reflective, the albedo goes down. And when that happens, the stuff it melts faster. And so what it does is it speeds up a positive feedback system in places like Greenland and the Arctic ice sheet, so that the ice melts faster, which then opens up more ocean for absorbing solar radiation during the summertime, and further warms up the water, which then further warms melts the ice. It's kind of a bad loop for us right now. In fact, probably, well, I don't know about me, but my grandson, who's now five, just started first grade, will live to see a time when there'll be open water at the North Pole in the summertime. So, the fires are, are have been terrible. I mean, where we are, you're in Philadelphia, right? Somewhere in there. Yeah. So, we're not that far away, but you probably saw the smoke too. I was giving a talk on a different topic, climate change, but not forest fires, to the League of Women Voters chapter at a local town on the day that the smoke reached New York City. And we're not too far, we're an hour and a half drive from New York City. And so when I went in to give this talk at this little restaurant, I was just your normal day in July. When I came out, everything was yellow. And you probably had something similar down where you are. And I didn't really know what it was. And then I turned on the radio in my car as I was driving home, and I heard it was the smoke. The fire had gotten so large, and the smoke had blown down to us. Now, the reason it came down to us was two reasons. One is the fires are huge, were huge, and the second is that the winds were blowing farther in a more north-south way than was usual. The jet stream was having one of its periodically zigzaggy type of configurations instead of more straight and wavy, and which means that we got blessed with a lot of that smoke. And of course it gets in your eyes and gets in your lungs, and it's terribly unhealthy to breathe, especially for anybody who has some sort of respiratory issue, or old folks, or young folks, or
Yeah, it was the first time I really paid attention to air quality measurements, and I think it was 457 was what we got up to, which was way red, obviously. And but yeah, I mean that was definitely changed things, I think, for a lot of people.
I grew up in Missouri, where forest fires are historically are occasionally happen, but not very much. And then I moved to Alaska, where forest fires are actually fairly common, but they're small scale, they're low intensity. But what we had in Canada was a different thing entirely. And
So what made the fires in Canada so much larger this year and ongoing? Like we're not even halfway through the year, and it's larger, more fire, destroyed more acreage than any other time.
yeah.
What makes it so much worse at this point compared to before?
You can say kind of it's the same thing that happened in Maui to a certain extent, which is you have excess heat, and when that warm air hits green things, it tends to dry them out. And you have plants that are losing water. You have the muskeg and the ground. Muskeg is this thing, this landform found in permafrosted areas that causes bumpy terrain. It's a pain to walk across, but tussocks and all that sort of stuff. And in it, you have a drawing out of that environment so that a spark and forest fires in the high latitudes tend to be lit by dry lightning, something that we don't consider much around here, which is lightning that is not directly associated, not directly followed by rain. And that lightning, Zeus hurling his lightning bolt is enough to set a fire without too much trouble at all. And that's in Alaska. That's where most of them are, dry lightning. And the fire will do lots of things. It'll burn the trees, but it'll also melt the permafrost in the area. And that's not an issue here, but it is in parts of Canada. Canada has got a permafrost zone just like Alaska does, and as Siberia does, and so on.
Does
And
the permafrost, when it melts, does that release methane or?
can, yeah, see, there's a bunch of bacteria that can live under anaerobic conditions in the absence of oxygen, but some of them will release methane as a waste product. They're called methanogenic bacteria. And so they're found in areas like the permafrost and the tundra and the tiger forest, where there's lots of organic matter for them to eat, but they don't have access to a lot of oxygen. And so they produce methane. And that methane can be released as it's produced, or it can be frozen into the permafrost. Now, permafrost is something that down here we don't think about too much, but it's really a big deal worldwide. It's an area permanently frozen soil below the surface layer that, I mean, in some places in Alaska, you try to dig a hole and you'll go down a few inches and you'll hit what seems to be concrete. And if you put your hand down there, it's frozen. It's ice. It's frozen soil. And that frozen soil keeps the organic matter in the soil from it, that it that it's that it, that is in that permafrost from decomposing and releasing CO2. When it gets warmer ish during the summer, and it also will encase CO2 and methane that are produced by bacteria of various kinds in that soil. And so that stuff is kind of sequestered away, and it's also found in the bottom of lakes and stuff up there, ponds. And this applies to northern Canada as well. And so when you melt the permafrost, you are releasing any gases that are trapped in the frozen part of the soil, and then they come out and do their nefarious things, what they do. Sometimes you also have old diseases popping up. Back in 2016, there was a warm snap in the Taimyr Peninsula in western Siberia. In a permafrosted area, which back in the teens and 20s had a anthrax outbreak, and it killed off a bunch of reindeer. Reindeer are the domestic version of caribou, and native peoples there will herd them. That's their livelihood. And when they lost all these reindeer, they had to scrape out shallow holes because they've got permafrost, and they put the reindeer in there in a big pile and covered them up in mounds, and where they froze until 2016, when it got warm. There was a heat dome in the northern Siberia, if you can believe that, and it thawed those carcasses, and anthrax started rushing
Wow.
through the human population. One small child died. So you can have, not only releasing gases, greenhouse gases, but also, obviously, now diseases, zombie anthrax.
What when you look at like the methane versus CO2, how do those compare in terms of the effect on climate and temperatures and so forth?
There are a number of gases which are greenhouse gases, meaning that their presence in the atmosphere will trap infrared that is radiating from the surface of the ground back up into the atmosphere. Some of them are weak, but some of them are plentiful, like water vapor. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas, but it is not molecule for molecule, not a very strong one. On the other hand, there's lots of it. Okay. But CO2 is usually when scientists study greenhouse gases, strength, they will scale them to CO2, you know, the CO2 being one. And that is a scale of one on a 20-year, for over a 20-year time span. Okay. Now I don't remember the numbers exactly, but methane is a much stronger one than CO2. It's something like a 17 on that scale. But there are much stronger ones too. You know, there's N2O, which is is associated with agriculture and things like that. And then there's the devil's own greenhouse gases, the CFCs. The chlorofluorocarbons, the hydrofluorocarbons were all produced by humans. They did not exist before we figured out ways to make them. And we make them and began to make them because they are extremely compressible and they're very good at, well, you know, when you and I were kids, if you got a can of spray paint to spray to put a new coat of paint on your bicycle, the gas that was inside that was decompressing when you pushed the button was probably freon. My mother she used to do her hair up into this big globe, and she used to use hairspray, which would glue it all down so the wind wouldn't mess it up. And that was also. But and so these CFCs and HFCs, industrial created gases do not exist in nature, are in a 17,000 time Mercalli
Wow.
scale. They're huge.
I
They're
didn't know
awful.
it was that much.
Well, they vary depending on which one. And they also have the effect of interfering with the ozone layer in the upper atmosphere, which causes those of us with pale skin to get bad burns and other things. So the word on among scientists is that the three things that we as a civilization need to address most are methane, and methane is also natural gas. For those of us who use natural gas for heating your home or cooking your food, it also comes out of oil wells that are not properly plugged after they are done. And so all this methane is just kind of spewing into the air. Pardon my dog. He just saw the UPS truck drive by. So methane and CFCs of various kinds, we need to stop those damn things. I tell students if they want to make a zillion dollars, they need to learn how to engineer chemicals and come up with a alternative to CFCs. And the third is we need to control soot. Soot is that thing that gets up in the atmosphere and spreads around the world and speeds up ice melt. Pardon my dog. Let me go see if I can. Oh, he's going back up. Sorry about that. At least you can edit this out, right?
Well, actually, no, but that's okay.
Oh yeah, okay, all
It's just we go with the flow.
right.
So it's interesting you don't mention CO2 as one of the things to.
It is not in those top three. And the reason is that it is a weaker greenhouse gas than the other two I mentioned. I don't know how they calculate, and I'm not sure which group has actually said this, but an environmental group basically said those three are the ones. If we have to focus on anything, those three are. And I think maybe it's the urgency. We have all these old pipes that are zombie oil wells and zombie gas wells and fracking wells and things like that, which the companies that drill them and pump the whatever it is, the hydrocarbons out of it, have not been appropriately policed in terms of sealing those things up. And so they just let them flow because, you know, if there's no one telling them they have to stop those wells, then they make money by not doing it.
Yeah. It's social cost. It's socialized expenses.
Yeah. And that's all part of the social cost of our hydrocarbon habit, you know, that we have. We choose not to spend money to enforce and political will to enforce those sorts of regulations. It's not that we don't have the regulations. We just don't choose to worry about it too much.
And that's distressing considering we're into year three of a Democratic administration and it's still not really enforced.
Well, it's also state governments, you know. Pennsylvania, I think there are old fracking wells and stuff. I'm not current. But, you know, those would probably be policed and enforced by the environmental organization, NPA. That doesn't mean the federal government doesn't have an input on it.
Yeah, we have a Democratic governor and who you would think is fairly progressive. He's a good guy. I've met him several times. But the fact that there's really no backbone when it comes to the carbon industry shows you the depth of the pockets of their influence in terms of either side of the aisle.
Well, you know, there is a lot of money and there's a lot of money to be made. And I think even well-meaning people, and there are well-meaning people in government, are tempted to think, well, okay, let's let it slide for now, but we'll fix it next time. But you know, the truth of it is there isn't a next time. I mean, we're all, you know, if you had kids, you probably told them to clean up their own messes when they left a mess at home. I'm sure your parents probably told you that. Mine told me that. You know, clean up your mess because you made the mess and you're responsible for that and no one else is responsible for cleaning up your mess.
Mm-hmm.
Now our kids and grandkids have every right and they should turn that around on us.
Yeah.
Because we have made messes, we have benefited from these messes and we're not cleaning them up sufficiently.
Mm-hmm. So what's some of the other information that you usually share in terms of your talks when you talk about the issue of heat and fire and what's going on in terms of the climate crisis?
Well, and I haven't been asked to do a talk specifically upon fire, fire weather, fire climate, which is the talks I'll be giving to libraries and senior centers and various places around here. But I'll always include those in my ecology course because fire is one of those, like I say, it's a good thing, bad. It's a good news, bad news sort of thing. It's one of those things that resets the environment. And some fires can be fairly low impact on the environment. And sometimes they can be just hell on earth, mm-hmm. all depending on the intensity of the fire. I mean, look at Maui. Place I've never been, but the pictures of post-fire in Maui are just apocalyptical.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't have information other than what I've heard in the news, but it makes some sense why that fire was so severe. There are certain things that cause a fire to be more severe. Okay. One is you got to have fuel. You got to have a spark. You got to have oxygen. Okay. and it will burn faster and hotter if the environment's dry. Okay, so what you had in Maui was all this invasive grass that was brought in to feed cattle. Okay, back in decades ago, African grasses that whenever they were senescent, whenever they were not active, they would basically lose their water on the above the ground part of the plant, and so they tended to burn like crazy when lit. You also had a hurricane offshore that was blowing wind onshore, which fanned the flames literally and metaphorically. And you had, I think, some pretty lackadaisical enforcement and operations in the local utility that didn't turn off the power when they should have, okay, when they knew that there was a fire around habitations. And there were some, I mean, I don't know the details, but it was things like that that all happened at the same time. And often these really bad disasters, natural disasters, happen from a variety of things, some of which are just bad luck of having that hurricane offshore to blow the fan, the flames at that particular time. And some of it is human hubris, and stupidity and greed that lay the situation, cause the situation by which in which you can have such a disaster occur. Now, the forest fires in Canada were, I mean, fires are natural. Fires happen. If you suppress a fire, if you, I mean, honestly, and if the fire was coming near your home, you would go out there and you would hope that the local authorities and firemen would keep that fire away from your home. And so you would suppress it. And that would be your natural instinct, and no one would blame you for doing it. However, when you have a relatively high human population in some of those areas and have large fires, the more you suppress them, the more the fuel builds up. And the more the fuel builds up, the worse the fire will be when it comes, and it will come. That's the thing. These things that we suppress are we're not suppressing them forever. We're just suppressing them temporarily because they will come. The disasters will come.
So are there
And
any strategies to address like this fire potential to that people can do in advance that would help minimize the potential damage that could come?
individuals would have a hard time. There's a lot of I mean, there's a lot of questions, or a lot of discussion among climate change activists and the people who study climate change and things like that. There are a range of things that individuals can do, like drive less, walk more, eat less meat, things like that, that are all good and healthy for us and everything else. There are other things that must be done at scale. Okay. At scale, which you and me and whatever of my neighbors I could talk into participating would not have enough, power to do. Okay. Some of these things have to be done at the large governmental scale. Okay. And so, there will, there some
What would some of those things be?
well, one thing that could be done was, I mean, could be done in some areas. It probably wouldn't stop the largest of fires, would be a clearing of areas, reducing of fuel load. It could mean setting fires, low intensity fires that you keep under control, in areas around human habitation, in expectation that there will be a big fire coming and you want to make it less big than it is. It's kind of a remedial thing that one might do. But no, it's not something that you and I could go do in our backyard. It's something that would have to
So
be
the
done at a governmental
gust of
scale.
wind comes along, it's blown out of control, and then,
But if there's fire, I mean, if there's a big fuel load and it's suppressed because no one wants their softball game interrupted, or they don't want the mess of having, smoke coming through their house and things like that. Those sorts of, if we suppress the fires so that the fuel load gets big, by the time the fire comes, and it will, you'll have a raging inferno. And sometimes it's just bad luck, there's, or work or karma. There's in Northern Alberta, there's this big tar sands petroleum mining area, which is strip mining of this gunk, which won't even hardly burn by itself, but has to be treated in such a way that you can actually get petroleum out of it. And there's tons of money to be made. It has tons of money has been made. And some years ago, they did have a fire. The fire wasn't directly involved with associated with the petroleum, but the tar, but it certainly blew through that big industrial complex. And there's a book out by it that I recently read, but I can't remember the name. Definitely worth it.
I had a question and it escaped my mind.
Let
It's
me follow up a little bit.
yeah.
There are some natural fires that generally stay on the ground and burn the understory. They burn shrubs and dry grasses and stuff, but they're low enough intensity that trees are not even killed by it. And some trees have extra thick bark so so they can survive a low-grade fire. When those things happen, it puts off the big fires. If the flame jumps up into the branches, up into the canopy, that kills the trees. That's a different thing entirely.
I remember what I was thinking. One of the factors I assume was driving the fires in Canada was less rain, drought kind of conditions. Is that accurate?
Yeah, there's something called a flash drought, and I've never heard of it until just this year. And it is a, and I have the formal definition. Let's see, flash drought is a type of drought characterized by its rapid onset, intensification, and severity over a relatively short time scale, usually within a few days or weeks. And so, under certain circumstances, and I am not entirely certain what those circumstances are, you can have a brief but intense drought that would make the conditions more favorable for fires. That apparently is what hit Maui, was a flash drought. Like I say, this is a new concept to me. I'm not familiar
Well,
with it.
the interesting thing about Maui is, and I've been to Maui like 7 or 8 times. I was fortunate that way. But on the north side of the island, it's very moist. Like the water comes in, it hits the mountains, goes up, and it drops down, right? Comes down the other side, and the wind is dry. And so the wind coming down that south side is absolutely no water vapor left in it. And so that south side around Lahaina, but also the south side of the other side of the island around Haleakala, which is Kihei area. I mean, they're very dry areas. You would think it's kind of akin to Arizona or, some sort of deserty kind of area. And you go 15 minutes north and you're in lush tropical jungle. It's that.
It's called a rain shadow, and you find it on the West Coast. On the if you've ever been to Washington, Oregon, if you're along the coastal portion of Washington, Oregon, there are rainforests in
Like San
the
Diego, you come over the mountains in San Diego as you go into land in San Diego.
summer.
Right before that, on the western side, it's it's dry desert. So
yeah, so I mean that's, you know, it's just the nature of the air moving at moist air moving up the mountain and losing its, you know. But and so I wasn't aware that there was a rain shadow sort of effect on the way down.
That's a huge thing. So, you know, the northern side of the island, its threat is flooding, right? It's the other
Much
side
rare.
of the climate crisis. So you can pick a place to be, but you gotta plan for your contingencies. My question about the drought in Canada was, you know, with all of the fires, you know, how long is it going to take the trees to regrow to kind of recapture that absorption capability that the leaves had in those forests?
It depends on where, you know, where you are, or how far south. I'm sure southern Alberta is probably a quicker grow back than northwest territories. You know, in Alaska, there's in interior Alaska, there's six species of trees, and there's a bunch of shrubs and stuff, and so it's pretty easy to study the successional, you know, sequence and all that. But I remember digging into the soils. I was working on soils and taking samples in a white spruce forest. And white spruce are the end of that successional sequence. They're the mature tree that is there the longest. And finding charcoal in the soil. And I was told by, you know, the professors who knew this stuff that was from a fire in that area in 1776. So, at least in that spot, interior Alaska, on a south-facing slope, no permafrost, white spruce were mature after, and this would have been in the 90s, so after 220 years.
Wow.
Now, you get to mid-succession type of communities, which there are poplars and aspens and things like that. Earlier, and some parts of Canada are going to be similar to that sequence. The farther south you go, the more species you'll have in there. You don't get to the canopy of the mature forest for quite a while, a couple hundred years. I mean, even around here, it would take, I don't know exactly how long it would take a mature oak tree or sugar maple to grow, but it's going to be in that range.
Well, I mean, the challenge is we're losing canopy in the Amazon. Now we're losing canopy in Canada, Africa as well. So it's like I would imagine these are creating the conditions for a hockey stick increase in CO2 accumulation.
We're losing our lungs, the Earth's lungs. And you know, I remember, what was it, a couple of years ago when they had all those fires that apparently were set on purpose in parts of the Amazon. I mean, how could you not see that and cry? I know I did.
Well, and again, that a lot of that is fed by the meat industry and
Soybeans.
cattling and soybeans to feed them, so.
Well, there's soybeans. There's a big market for soybeans in some parts of Asia because it's used in food things, and so some of the clearing was so they plant soybeans, but a lot of it was cattle, no question.
So you work with a lot of, you have a lot of students. How many students do you usually have per year taking your classes?
Let's see, depends on, you know, there were small state schools are subject to demographics, and we're going through kind of a trough in demographics right now. And all the little state schools are having the same kind of issues. Let's see, I have 28 in my ecology course, which is enough to have two lab sections, and I sometimes will have as many as 45, depending on, you know, who started the year before and things like that. I have a general education climate change course, among other things, and that's a one that any old person can take. There's students, you know, there are students who are required to take courses outside their topic, you know, outside their major, just to kind of broaden out. And those are called general education courses, right? And so I purposely made one that, you know, the nursing students could take, and the musical theater music students would take. I've had a number of musical theater students in my climate change course, and I keep hoping that they're going to break out in song, but they've disappointed me so far.
Have you ever thought about doing a climate change course for the business education people?
Yeah, actually, one of the management professors is a member of our Jane Goodall Center. It's an environmental organization we have. We're blessed with having a long running connection with Jane Goodall, and so I've met her 4 or 5 times. You know, which awesome. Is how many people can say, can say
that's
that?
Amazing.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing, and so anyway, this particular professor asked me to come give talks at her management courses, and she's filmed them, and she's been showing the same talk for several years now. I'm going to encourage her to record a new one or something, because there's lots of new information. Also, our business school has, in part, you know, environment is part of their, is part of the things that they care about officially in their paperwork now.
Good. So that's good to see, because it's, yeah, you know, we have to get to the point where we're changing the way that we live our lives in terms of our working lives. We can't afford to divide the two.
We have to encourage business students to care about more than their pocketbook. They got to care about their hearts and the hearts of their children and their grandchildren, you know, because this is all, I'm a firm believer in the golden rule. And, you know, we treat people the way we want to be treated. And that applies not only to a person who, you know, members of your family and people you know that are the same age, but it should apply across to every person on earth. So what I do, I'm responsible for treating them right over in Thailand or over in Africa where my wife's from and things like that. And it has to move through time. For instance, the Iroquois people, the Haudenosaunee, had this idea called the seventh generation ethic. Familiar with that? So, you know, you make decisions today that are with the good of seven generations in the future to come. Okay, in their best interest. And if you do that, and you act in the best interest of people in other parts of the world who you've never met and you've never visited, it's hard to imagine if that won't help.
Yeah. Well, it's tough to have a business and an economy that's going to succeed in the world where we're in the direction that we're headed. So we need to change course.
Yeah, there's no profit on a dead planet.
No, not at all. Not at all. Yeah. If people want to reach out to you to learn more about the work that you do, your talks and so forth, how can they do that?
Well, you are welcome to share my email address. It's, but I'll give it to you now. wagenerm@wcsu.edu. And that's just my university email address.
Awesome.
And, if any of you have groups that you would like me to do a Zoom talk with slides and all that sort of stuff, I'd be delighted to do it. And I actually, sometime later this month, I will have done my 200th public talk on climate change.
Wow. Impressive.
Well, since 2008, so.
Well, I applaud your effort, and again, I see you on Facebook in terms of the work that you do, and I think it's important for all of us to keep carrying the message forward.
Yeah, you know, I have a grandson, and I've got a granddaughter on the way, and it's hard for me not to fight for them.
I'm with you, brother. With you. Thanks again, and I'll talk to you again soon.